the man is dangerous. You didn't see the way he looked at you in that courtroom.
I was there, said Janie, looking at him critically.
He seemed to be breathing easier with his ice-encrusted coat and scarf off, but his frame was still racked with shudders, and there was a purple tinge to his lips she didn't like.
You need to get warm. It's too cold in the hall. You'll come down with pneumonia.
That's not all. Burke staggered and caught himself against the back of a chair. He's in debt. Lots of debt. Needs Annabel Lacey's money.
Janie caught Burke's arm, bracing him with her body. Come into the parlor. There's a fire there.
And also Mr. Lacey. But they could deal with that when they came to it.
You don't have a bag, do you?
Mr. Burke tried to grin, but his facial muscles didn't seem to want to work properly. Didn't think that far ahead. When I heard, I ran.
Never mind. I'm sure we can find something of Bay's.
And never mind that her mother would consider that heresy.
How did you learn about Mr. Lacey?
I have friends in low places. Burke stumbled as they walked into the passage, but Janie managed to right them. Sorry, not so steady. Lacey bribed the port officer to falsify the date of his arrival.
He's here, you know, said Janie.
No, said Burke. Didn't want to leave you here alone with him.
So you came rushing through the ice?
Janie didn't know whether to be touched or shake him for being so foolish.
Slaying a dragon would have been easier and warmer.
Burke winced as he flexed a hand. Foolish. When I couldn't get you on the phone. Didn't think. I thought I could get a cab at the station.
Don't think I don't appreciate it,
said Janie politely, pushing down an entirely inappropriate giddiness. She drew her wrap more snugly around her shoulders.
All acts of knight-errantry are much appreciated, even if unnecessary. If anyone kills anyone, it won't be Giles Lacey. It will be my mother.
With me the target? Burke's blue lips parted in something that was almost a grin.
You'll have to get in line, said Janie. If Mr. Lacey tells us one more time that Illyria is an inferior copy of Lacey Abbey, my mother may take a poker to him.
She slowed and stopped as she saw the way Burke was looking at her. He took a deep breath, speaking with an effort. I'd meant to take you away with me. Back to Cold Spring, if not to town. But now, I've made a proper mess of this rescue, haven't I? She might have made light of it, but something in Burke's face blunted easy banter. He had, realized Janie with a constriction in her chest, been genuinely afraid for her. It must be very lowering to come charging to the rescue only to be thwarted by the elements. Janie chose her words carefully.
If Mr. Lacey is a villain, I believe he is one of impulse. He lost his temper and used the weapons that were to hand.
A single blow, the coroner had said. She tilted her head to look at Burke.
Perhaps your being here will be enough to blunt that impulse.
Is this an attempt to salvage my pride? He demanded hoarsely.
Yes, said Janie, but that doesn't mean it isn't also true.
For a moment she felt his damp head rest against hers. Lifting it, he said, Shall we beard the dragon? Janie stopped him before he could move forward.
Do we tell him we know, or pretend and wait?
I'm used to writing about dark deeds, not living them, said Burke grimly, and Janie felt heartened because he sounded more like himself. What do you think? Janie bit her lip.
There are four of us, and only one of him.
You, Miss Van Dyvel, have the face of a lady and the soul of a bandit, said Mr. Burke. All right, let's go poke the tiger. You wouldn't happen to have a weapon handy.
Does scorn count?
It's not very useful in hand-to-hand combat. Burke grinned at her, the effect only slightly marred by the fact that he was still shivering. Shall we? Your mother can always belt him with the poker if he gets out of hand.
When they opened the parlor doors, they were greeted with a rush of smoke, and the sight of Mr. Lacey's backside as he bent over the fire, poking futilely at the coals.
"Can anyone do anything about this this fire? It's like Hades in here."
At the sound of footsteps, Lacey turned, squinting at them through the smoke, which all appeared to be going in instead of out.
"Who's this? The chimney sweep, I hope."
"This," said Janey, "is Mr. Burke, of the News of the World."
"Not," contributed Anne, "an Eskimo."
Lacey turned, the poker still in his hand.
"You don't mean to tell me the press are stalking us through the snow?"
"Apparently," said Janey's mother acidly.
She would not, Janey knew, refer to Anne's past transgressions in front of Mr. Lacey. Solidarity in distress went only so far. To Janey she added,
"I told you to take him to the kitchens."
"Mr. Burke has come all this way, at great personal danger, because he had news for us."
Janey could feel a slow burn of anger in her chest. She nurtured it, letting it warm her, letting it drive away her doubts and fears. A new Janey, born from the flames like a phoenix.
"You lied, Mr. Lacey. You lied about when you arrived in New York. You weren't on the—"
She had forgotten the name of the ship.
"St. Paul," supplied Burke.
"Thank you," said Janey. She turned back to Lacey. "You arrived on the Britannic."
Mr. Lacey poked at the fire. "What's the difference between one ship or another?"
"The difference," said Janey, "is 10 days. You were here on the night of the ball."
On the side of the room, Anne half rose from her seat, one hand tight on the red velvet arm.
"What?"
"What's more," said Janey, keeping her eyes on Mr. Lacey and his poker, "you lied about it. You went to the portmaster and paid him to change his records."
"Well, yes."
Mr. Lacey waved a dismissive hand, accidentally thwacking a table in the process. He looked down and realized he was holding the poker, and with a shrug, dropped it.
"I didn't want anyone getting the wrong idea."
"The wrong idea?"
Anne's voice rose on the last word. Her face was very pale in the lamplight. Her rouge stood out like stains on her cheeks.
"You mean the idea that you just might have killed my cousin and his wife? That idea?"
"See, that's just what I mean."
Lacey choked on the smoke from the fire.
"It would be just like that whore to try to ruin me from beyond the grave."
"Language, Mr. Lacey," snapped Janey's mother.
"There are ladies present."
Anne shot her aunt a look of pure hatred.
"That's all you can say? Language? Do you have no feelings? Do you not care the least little bit that—"
"Control yourself!"
Mrs. Van Dyvel's voice slashed through the air like a knife. Anne froze, and in the silence Mr. Lacey's voice rose up, loud and petulant.
"She tricked you. Georgie tricked all of you. Wouldn't think it to look at her, would you? Oh, no, butter wouldn't melt in her mouth. But there she stood, cool as ice."
"And what about Bay?"
demanded Anne in a tight voice. She was standing, one hand on the arm of her chair, her knuckles white.
"What did he do to you?"
I told you!"
Mr. Lacey looked from one to the other as the impact of his own words hit him.
"I never touched him, never even met him. Devil take it, I pitied the man. He'd been gulled right and proper. She was poison, that girl. Pure poison."
"And what," said Janey, in a voice she didn't recognize as her own, "would she have said about you, Mr. Lacey?"
Janey felt Burke step closer to her, prepared to jump to her defense.
"Lies," Lacey said tightly. "Whatever she told you, it was all a lie." "I should never have let Bay go abroad."
Mrs. Van Dyvel paced the back of the room, her heavy skirts sweeping the Aubusson rug.
"I should have known what would come of it. He didn't have the strength to take care of himself, to guard himself from fortune hunters."
"Annabel wasn't a fortune hunter," said Anne flatly.
"I've told you," said Mr. Lacey. "She wasn't Annabel."
"He's right. She wasn't." Even Janie's mother stopped to stare. Burke looked apologetically at Janie.
That was the other news from London. There was a Georgiana Smith, companion to Miss Annabel Lacey. No one knew what happened to her. She disappeared at the same time as Miss Lacey.
"See," said Mr. Lacey triumphantly.
"I told you.
Some people thought the gypsies took them,"
said Burke, his voice carrying over the other man's.
"Others suspected Mr. Lacey. A groom reported hearing cries from the stables."
Mr. Lacey's eyes darted around the room.
"What does a groom know? All right, damn you, he heard something, but it wasn't what you think. He heard me trying to get that witch to tell me what she'd done with Annabel."
"Unless," retorted Burke, "he'd heard you murdering Annabel Lacey."
If Mr. Lacey wasn't horrified, he was doing a good job of pretending it.
"Murder Annabel? I loved her. I would never have hurt her."
"So you say. It's not so pleasant when the shoe is on the other foot, is it, Mr. Lacey?"
Burke was all reporter now, following up on a lead.
"You can make accusations, but you can't take them."
"Enough!"
Mrs. Van Dyvel's voice made them all start.
"It was her fault. All of it. That Georgiana."
Mrs. Van Dyvel came to a stop on the far side of the room, where her own portrait hung in pride of place, so that she seemed to be glaring at them twice over. Janie's mother had never liked that portrait, had felt the painter had failed to do her justice. So it had been long since exiled from the house in Newport to a dark corner on 36th Street, and then at last as a gift to Bay and Annabel for their new home. In the painting she was dressed in the grand tenue of the early 80s, her magnificent pearls hanging in long strands around her neck, and her bosom adorned with a large diamond brooch. A very familiar diamond brooch. Janie felt the cold seeping down the back of her neck. A goose walking over her grave, Mrs. Garrett would say. But it wasn't her grave it was walking over.
"You," her mother said, jabbing a finger at Burke. "You claim to be a journalist. Do your job properly. Tell the world about the impostor who lied and cheated and killed my son. Tell them that it was all her fault, all of it. If Bayard hadn't married that woman..."
Her mother's words crashed and eddied around her as Janie stared at the portrait over her mother's head, the brooch on her painted chest, the giant round diamond in the middle with the finials radiating out like the rays of an icy sun.
"That's your brooch."
Janie wasn't aware that she had spoken until her mother broke off to look at her sharply.
"Did you say something, Janie?"
It was a look that told her she was to be sent to bed with supper on a tray, given a tisane, silenced. But Janie wouldn't be silenced, not anymore.
"That brooch,"
she said, and her voice was stronger than she would have imagined. She lifted a finger to point at the painting above her mother's head.
"The brooch they found by the folly. It was yours."
The wind shook the windows. The coals cracked and sparked on the grate. Anne drew in her breath with a sharp hiss. Mrs. Van Dyvel stared at the portrait as though she had never seen it before.
"A maid,"
she began, and then with more conviction.
"Anne always has her fingers in my jewel box. She must have borrowed it."
Wordlessly, Anne shook her head.
"Would someone tell me what the devil is going on?"
demanded Giles Lacey.
"Who cares about a bloody brooch?"
This time no one reproved him for language.
"Mother,"
said Janie, and her voice felt strange to her ears.
"Why was your brooch by the folly?"
Her mother's hand went to the mourning brooch at her neck, tightening around it so hard that Janie thought it might crack.
"If you must know..."
Her lips twisted as she looked behind Janie.
"Do make sure you are writing this down, Mr. Burke. I shouldn't want you to miss anything."
"Mother,"
prompted Janie. The smoke from the fire was making her eyes sting, scraping the back of her throat. In the silence, the wind howled around the windows like a lost soul.
"My brooch was there because I was there," I was there when that woman killed my son.
Chapter 26. Cold Spring, 1899. Twelfth Night.
What country, friend, is this?
Demanded the herald, as he had been demanding every 5 minutes by the clock for the past hour.
This,
shouted back his counterpart on the other side of the door,
is Illyria.
Then they both lifted their trumpets to their lips for a royal, if slightly ragged, fanfare. Georgie was beginning to hate those bloody trumpets.
Welcome, she said for the 500th time. Welcome to Illyria.
So good of you, Bay was saying by her side. So good of you to come. To their left, the scene began again.
What country, friend?
Georgie turned her head and grimaced at Bay. His eyes crinkled back at her, and she felt something catch in her chest at the ease of it, the familiarity. They had always been able to speak without words. Just not about the things that mattered.
Welcome to Illyria.
This time it was a man dressed in gold-chased armor so heavy that it creaked while he walked. Oliver Belmont? Georgie wasn't sure. The visor had been down. What she was sure of was that whoever it was would dearly regret his costume choice within 5 minutes of entering the ballroom. It might be January, but the 400 were generating their share of body heat.
So good of you to come, said Bay at her side.
Vizards and masks and visors, farthingales and ruffs and doublets. There were at least a dozen Mary Queen of Scots, and, much to her mother-in-law's annoyance, 6 rival Elizabeths. There were Sir Walter Raleigh's and Sir Philip Sidney's spouting verse, and a mournful Prospero toting his book and tripping over his robes, never mind that he was from the wrong play. In all the mass of colorful characters, there was no sign of Giles. That surprised her. She had rather expected him to stroll through the receiving line just to put her on her guard, just to see what she would do. She was, Georgie thought wryly as she murmured greetings to yet another faceless guest, doing Giles too much credit. This was her fief, not his. Giles only had the gall to exercise his droit de seigneur, where he knew he ruled unchallenged. Nothing? Murmured Bay in her ear, and Georgie shook her head in response.
"This isn't Shakespeare," she muttered to him. "It's Dante."
"The circle he never mentioned."
Bay's face lit as he looked at her. There was a tenderness to it that made her chest ache.
"Condemned to hear the same lines from Twelfth Night over and over from now into eternity."
Georgie smiled back with an effort.
"We've made our own inferno."
"Not much longer now," said Bay, and she knew he wasn't just talking about the receiving line. They'd agreed to postpone any discussion of their future until after the ball. It lent a strange poignancy to the simplest utterances, the most mundane gestures. Watching Bay spoon jam onto his muffin at breakfast had nearly made her weep.
"We've stood here long enough to satisfy the sticklers."
"Good. This dress weighs more than the twins."
It had seemed such a statement to wear no jewels, to have crystals and aquamarines embroidered into the fabric of her gown, one in the eye for the gem-decked matrons. But she could feel the weight of Bay's wealth dragging her down. Bay put a hand to the dagger at his belt.
"Would you like me to slash your laces?"
"Stop playing with that," said Georgie. "You'll hurt yourself."
Bay looked like Bast, balked of a toy.
"It's just a bauble."
"A very sharp bauble."
A band of wandering minstrels roamed past, crooning about greensleeves.
"If you must use it, apply it to the man with the lute."
"He wasn't that bad," said Bay.
His eyes met hers, that deceptively clear blue, like the sky on a cloudless day.
"He's simply not as good as you."
So many memories. It was as if burning their past had simply released it into the air between them. They couldn't take a breath without choking on memories. Despite herself, Georgie reached for her husband's hand, squeezed it.
I'm done performing, remember?
I know, said Bay, and there was so much unspoken between them that Georgie couldn't stand it anymore.
I need a breath of air, she said, faking a smile as best she could. We've nearly an hour until the German. Make sure everyone's tucked in at the trough.
Bay covered her hand in his, a courtly gesture that caused whispers and snickers among the viewers. Don't be too long. We don't know who might be out there.
Don't worry.
In defiance of the crowd, Georgie lifted a hand to Bay's cheek, and then wished she hadn't. The illusion of intimacy came too close to the real thing.
I'm not afraid of Giles anymore.
Bay smiled ruefully at her, a perfect Renaissance prince. That's what scares me. Georgie wrinkled her nose at him over her shoulder and swirled away, or as much as one could swirl in a skirt braced with horsehair and weighed down with semi-precious stones. Around her, the ball was proceeding apace. The supper was already set out in the dining room. The dancing would begin again at 1, when she and Bay would open the German. Even her mother-in-law couldn't find fault with the arrangements. Or rather, she would, but it wouldn't be Georgie's fault. Upstairs, through the balusters of the gallery, she could see 2 white nightgown figures, their nurses' hands bunched in the fabric on each side. Georgie considered going up, but she knew that if she did, she might never come down again.
Don't go, Bay had told her. We can make this right.
She had agreed that they could discuss it later, but deep down she knew she had already made her decision. She didn't want to live her life in thrall to Lacey Abbey anymore, living first in Annabelle's shadow, then Bay's. She wanted to find her own place, whatever and wherever that might be. What would it be to strike off into the world? Not running, not afraid. She could take the twins to Venice and scold them out of plunging into the canals. Take them to ride on the donkeys in the Tuileries garden. She could feel exhilaration rising at the thought, and a strange sense of rightness. As much as she loved Bay, she didn't want to see Bast and Vi raised as he had been raised, stifled into correctness, swimming on a rocky beach because it was where our people went, or twisting themselves into molds that didn't fit because people might snicker at the opera. She would raise them to be strong and free. With the freedom that came of having the Van Dyvel money and name. There was that, but she was a pragmatist, wasn't she? She wasn't ashamed of using the tools that came to hand.
May I have a word?
It was David, dressed as Michelangelo, complete with tights, floppy hat, and easel. Georgie put an arm familiarly through his. Amazing how much more affectionate she could feel towards David now that he was no longer a rival.
I was just going to get a breath of air. Come with me.
Is that wise? David glanced over his shoulder, where 6 people were marking their conversation with interest.
Possibly the wisest thing we've done.
Georgie deliberately leaned into his arm, making David twist nervously. She batted her eyelashes at him.
Shall we give them 1 last show, for Bay's sake?
That was what I wanted to talk to you about. David dropped his voice as she led him out through the French doors onto the winter-blasted balcony. Chinese lanterns glimmered in front of them like fairy lights, stretching down the terraces to the river. But there was an emptiness to it. The women in gowns and gallants with swords at their waists, who ought to have been trysting among the topiary, were wisely remaining inside by the warmth of the supper table. Only the shadows kissed beneath the lanterns. David was shivering in his doublet, his teeth chattering as he said,
I wanted you to know. I'm leaving after the ball.
Georgie looked up at him, the cold forgotten. Something about the way he said it made her feel very old and very cynical. There was something about noble gestures that brought out her worst impulses. She also suspected that Bay had put him up to it. Because Bay, no matter how much he might love David, was his mother's child first. Heaven help anyone who sullied the noble name of Van Dyvel. As gently as she could, she said,
There's no need, David.
David walked beside her down the lantern-strung paths. The high yew bushes hid them from the house.
I won't be the cause of your leaving Bay.
She could tell him that he wasn't, that if it wasn't him, it would be someone else. But that would be petty. Instead, she said thoughtfully,
I've always thought it would be horrible to be Count Paris. No one wants to be the person to stand between Romeo and Juliet.
Bay would have had a quick response for her. David just looked uncertain. Shakespeare wasn't his chosen tongue. No one's going to take poison.
I didn't mean it literally.
They walked together for a moment, David thoughtfully matching his pace to hers.
I'm tired of being the odd one out. I want something of my own, David. Is that so strange?
David cast a quick, worried look down at her. But you're married.
That didn't stop you from falling in love with my husband, Georgie almost said, but held her tongue.
Instead, borrowing a phrase from Anne, she said lightly,
We're almost in the new century, after all. If Mrs. Vanderbilt can divorce, why can't a Van Dyvel?
Annabel!
It was Elizabeth the First standing behind them, in all her offended majesty. There might be half a dozen Elizabeths at the ball, but this was the only one who mattered, her mother-in-law, in red wig, ropes of pearls, and a face that sank a thousand ships.
What do you think you're doing?
Brilliant. This was all she needed. Georgie looked at her mother-in-law.
Were you following me?
Mrs. Van Dyvel seemed taken aback at being on the receiving end of the interrogation.
Someone needed to remind you of the proprieties, Annabel.
She looked pointedly at David.
Since you don't appear to be able to control yourself.
I'll just be going back to the house, murmured David, and suited actions to words.
Is that the sort of man for whom you would risk my son's good name?
Mrs. Van Dyvel's bosom had swollen to truly alarming proportions. Georgie had an image of the bodice bursting, scattering pearls and diamonds and wounded vanity.
"'It's not what you think,' said Georgie, as she walked away, just away, because she didn't have the patience to deal with Mrs. Van Dyvel,
not on top of David, not on top of everything else.
"'No, it's worse than I thought!'
Mrs. Van Dyvel's voice rose as Georgie kept walking.
"'What do you think you're doing?' Come back here! Don't you turn your back on me!
Georgie could hear the slap of Mrs. Van Dyvel's slippers on the frost-hardened gravel behind her. And behind them, another pair of shoes, moving fast, as a male form burst onto the path between them.
Mother?
Bay caught up with them by the overlook at the entrance to the folly, skidding to a stop between them.
What are you doing out here?
Mrs. Van Dyvel looked down at Georgie, her elaborately curled wig adding an extra 4 inches to her height.
"'Ask your wife!'
So Bay did.
"'Is everything all right?'
He took Georgie's hands, chafing them to warm them. Georgie would have been amused at the look of consternation on Mrs. Van Dyvel's face if she hadn't been feeling so unsettled.
"'Someone saw you go outside.' When I saw David come back without you, you don't know who might be out here.
Georgie pressed her eyes shut.
It's all right, Bay.
Mrs. Van Dyvel's heavy skirts rustled behind them.
No, she said shrilly, it is not. This woman you married has no concept of propriety, no concern for your reputation, no respect for the family name. If I hadn't intervened... What?
Demanded Georgie.
What would have happened? People would have whispered. They're whispering already. And why?
Demanded Mrs. Van Dyvel.
Because you have carried on like a common trollop.
Mother.
Bay cast a pleading look at Georgie, but Georgie crossed her arms over her chest and took a step back.
It's bad enough,
said Mrs. Van Dyvel, the diamonds at her breast flashing in the light of the lanterns.
that I have to endure your cousin's indiscretions. That actor, and now this nonsense with Teddy. I would have expected better from a Newland, but at least I could take comfort in the fact that the Vandyval name, our name, was free of stain. And now this. Did you know that your wife was planning to run off with that architect?
No, said Georgie, her eyes meeting Bay's. I'm not.
She isn't, Mother, said Bay, and Georgie rolled her eyes at him for the fact that his mother still had the power to reduce her husband to a schoolboy.
Oh, no?
Mrs. Vandyval drew herself up to an impressive height, her wide skirts adding to her majesty. To Georgie, she said,
If you won't have a care for my son's name, at least think of your children.
Georgie felt something snap.
I am thinking of my children. Do you think I'd let you have any hand in the raising of them after what you've done to yours? Your daughter is afraid to say boo to a goose, and your son had to run halfway around the world to get away from you.
Bayard!
Mrs. Vandyval looked to her son, who looked as though he would rather be anywhere rather than where he was.
Bayard, I expect you to do something about your wife.
What? Demanded Georgie. Lock me in a tower? Commit me to an asylum? On what grounds? Insufficient reverence for the Vandyval name?
Mother, Annabel. Bay strove for peace and got glared at by both sides. Can we continue this discussion another time? Our guests
will all be extremely edified by the sight of your wife running off with her lover,
retorted Mrs. Vandyval. Georgie spoke through clenched teeth.
Mr. Proyne is not my lover.
Mrs. Vandyval gave a short, mirthless laugh.
Don't take me for a fool. I know what I see when I see it.
No, said Georgie, feeling the cold biting through her dress, creeping beneath her skirts, making her skin crack.
She was cold and angry, and she had had enough. Heaven only knew she had sinned, but she was sick of being blamed for sins that weren't her own.
You don't. Mr. Proyne isn't my lover. He's your son's.
From the corner of her eye, she saw Bay press his eyes briefly shut.
What did you say?
Mrs. Vandyval was all indignation, rounding on Georgie with her scepter held like a spear. But Georgie didn't miss the way her eyes flicked towards Bay, and then away again.
It wasn't enough to cuckold my son. Now you feel the need to malign him? If I ever hear you utter such nonsense, such ludicrous nonsense! Mother!
Bay had to raise his voice to make himself heard.
Mother, it's not nonsense. It's true.
Mrs. Vandyval made a noise like a bellows deflating.
No,
she said flatly. Bay hesitated, but he didn't falter. His eyes met Georgie's, rueful, resolved.
Yes.
Mrs. Vandyval stepped towards him.
You will not, she said succinctly, say that again. This did not happen. This conversation did not happen.
Just the way my final year at the law school didn't happen, said Bay with a tired smile. I can pretend in public, Mother, but not for you, and certainly not for my wife.
Your wife?
Mrs. Vandyval turned back to Georgie, her voice dripping venom.
None of this needed to have been said but for you. None of this will be said again. Send the architect away. Goodness knows he's outlived his use. All of his uses.
Georgie saw Bay wince at his mother's casual treatment of his lover. She might have had her own battles with Bay over David, but it was none of Mrs. Vandyval's affair, and certainly not like this.
That isn't your decision to make, said Georgie levelly.
It's Bay's, and mine, not yours.
You made it my concern, retorted her mother-in-law. All you needed to do was turn a blind eye. Do you think I cared that my husband shared his bed with a pile of dusty books? Stop whining and fulfill your social obligations.
Your social obligations, said Georgie, not mine. The breath misted around Mrs. Vandyval's mouth like a dragon in a storybook.
You married into them when you married into this family.
If Georgie hadn't wanted a divorce before, she would certainly be demanding one now. She spoke in her most Annabelle voice, all clipped hauteur.
And I'll be free of them when I'm no longer in this family.
No.
Mrs. Van Dyvel moved so quickly that the jewels on her breast formed a rainbow blur. She snatched the dagger from Bay's belt, holding it up so that the tip dazzled in front of Georgie's eyes.
There will be no divorce.
Just a bauble, Bay had said. But it was a bauble with a very sharp point. Mrs. Van Dyvel glittered with diamonds and rage, as if every irritant, every slight had come to this, had narrowed to this moment, to Georgie. The rage of a monarch who saw his kingdom slipping from his grasp, his power waning.
"Put down the knife, mother," said Bay,
but Mrs. Van Dyvel didn't pay any notice. Georgie took a step back, keeping one eye on the dagger.
"If divorce was good enough for Henry VIII, surely it's good enough for a Van Dyvel."
Her mother-in-law was not impressed.
"I will not,"
said Mrs. Van Dyvel, stalking forward as Georgie retreated.
"Have you dragging our good name through the mud?"
"There needn't be a scandal," said Bay quietly, his eyes meeting Georgie's. "We can divorce in Rhode Island. Their divorce laws are laxer than New York's. And the Newport house is in my name. We'll have no trouble establishing residency."
"There will be no divorce."
Georgie's back bumped into the stone of the balustrade. The tip of the dagger pressed against the silver lace edging the square bodice, silver against silver.
"If you won't take your wife in hand, I will."
Georgie sucked in her breath at the touch of the cold steel.
"You don't want to do this," said Georgie breathlessly. "Think what a scandal it would cause if you skewered your son's wife."
Bay cast her a warning look.
"Put down the knife, mother."
"Not,"
said Mrs. Van Dyvel, "until you both see sense.
There cannot be a divorce, not now, not ever. Do you want people to speculate, to know?"
The point pressed deeper. Georgie could feel the cool damp of blood sticking to the silver lace. Just a trickle. Surely she wouldn't go farther than that. But the knife was sharp, frighteningly sharp. Bay put a hand on his mother's arm, speaking in his most sensible voice.
"This isn't your decision to make."
Mrs. Van Dyvel's lip curled.
"You'll just let her do this? You'll let her make a mockery of you? Of us?"
Bay's eyes met Georgie's, and for just a moment she saw in them what she'd seen all those years ago, something that made her feel as though, after a long journey, she had come home.
"If that's what she wants."
In a moment of ill-judged levity, he added, "After all, if Mrs. Vanderbilt can do it..."
"Do not talk to me about that woman!"
Mrs. Van Dyvel turned sharply towards her son, letting Georgie go so abruptly that Georgie stumbled back against the balustrade, catching herself just in time to see Bay stagger back, both hands closed around something that was protruding from his chest, a look of shock on his face. Mrs. Van Dyvel's face was no less shocked than Bay's, her mouth a red circle in the midst of her white face paint.
"Georgie,"
Bay said, and tried to reach for her, but he stumbled instead, weaving like a drunkard. The sapphire in the hilt of the dagger gleamed darkly between Bay's fingers as he slumped to his knees.
"Bay!"
Regaining her wits, Georgie flung herself towards him, but two hands caught her squarely in the chest, pushing her back hard enough to knock the breath out of her.
"You!"
The words came out as a hiss.
"This was your doing!"
And that was the last Georgie heard, as her mother-in-law's hands pushed her again, knocking her back over the balustrade. She grabbed at the ropes of pearls hanging from her mother-in-law's breast, but caught only something cold and hard that came off in her hand and clattered to the ground as the force catapulted her over, over, backwards over the balustrade.
"Georgie!"
She thought she heard her name on Bay's lips, but then there was nothing but the sensation of falling. Falling, falling down, deep into the icy waters below. Chapter 27 Cold Spring, 1899, February 11th.
Do you know what it's like to witness the death of your child? Can you imagine it, Mr. Burke?
Mrs. Van Dyvel addressed herself to Burke as though delivering the story for posterity. Not to her daughter, not to her niece, to the press.
Not an ordinary death, not a death by mischance or disease, a death by malice, murder.
You came back to the ballroom. Anne rose from her chair, her fingers tight on the embroidered arm.
You came back to the ballroom. You sent me to look for him.
Mrs. Van Dyvel didn't look at her niece. She kept her gaze fixed on Burke.
Do you know what it is to see your child murdered? My child, my only son. You left him there.
It was Anne's voice, raw and fearful.
You left him there and sent me to find him.
Janie felt as though she were falling, clutching at handholds. Her mother had known. Her mother had seen it all. And yet she had come back to the ballroom and danced.
Why didn't you say? If you knew...
Mrs. Van Dyvel glanced fiercely at her, and Janie saw her mother's face clench in an attempt to maintain control.
Your brother was dead. Did it matter?
Yes,
Janie burst out.
If someone had come sooner, perhaps...
He was dead.
Mrs. Van Dyvel's voice cracked through the room.
He was still alive when we found him, lying in the cold by himself.
Janie could feel herself shaking. How long had it taken before Anne had found her in the supper room? How long until they discovered Bay?
If you had raised the alarm, if you had let anyone know...
No,
Mrs. Van Dyvel shook her head. No.
Oh, God. Was that why you sent me?
Anne was staring at her aunt with a combination of loathing and horror.
I always knew you hated me, but I never knew how much. You wanted them to think I did it. You wanted them to think I killed Bay.
Don't be ridiculous.
For a moment, Mrs. Van Dyvel sounded like herself again, uttering her favorite phrase. And then her voice faltered.
There would have been questions. Do you think I wanted my grandson's mother branded a murderess? You knew nothing. It was safer that way.
Safer for whom?
With her hair glowing red gold in the lamplight, Anne looked like an avenging angel, the sort who wielded sword rather than harp.
Not for Bay.
Bay was dead.
Janie's mother wrung her hands, shaking as though she had been the one in the cold.
He was gone. Gone! What good would it do? Let them think it was a tramp, a vagrant, a robber.
But they hadn't thought that. Bay had been branded a murderer. The papers, the inquest, all the doubt and the questions and the worry. Through a fog, Janie felt Burke's hand beneath her elbow, steadying her.
All these weeks, not knowing, with the papers saying such awful things about Bay... How could you just stand by and watch it happen?
He was dead.
The windows rang with the words. Mrs. Van Dyvel glanced over her shoulder, a strangely furtive look.
She killed him, that woman. She took my son away from me. She took my son away from me, and she killed him.
No.
It was Anne who spoke, Anne who took a step forward, her eyes fixed on her aunt.
She loved him. They may not have been perfect lovers, but she loved him. Why would Annabelle kill Bay?
Because she wasn't Annabelle,
interjected Giles Lacey, rubbing his wrists. I keep telling you that.
Loved him?
Mrs. Van Dyvel couldn't seem to stay still. She paced the room, her long skirt brushing the carpet, bumping against the furniture.
Ha! She wanted a divorce. She wanted a divorce so that she could run off with that architect of hers. Ridiculous man. He can't even design a working chimney.
Did she really think he would waltz her off to an absurd lover's paradise?
Recalling herself, she raised her chin, saying, Bay wouldn't have it, of course. He told her no.
And she stabbed him?
Said Janie. She couldn't wrap her head around it. She could see Annabelle and Bay together, Annabelle's head barely reaching Bay's shoulder, small-boned and slight, her wrists nearly as slim as Viola's. Janie looked at Burke.
She was so little.
Anne's face was very still, her eyes very bright.
No, she said. Annabelle would never have run off with David Proyne.
Why not?
Demanded Mrs. Van Dyvel.
Do you think that you're the only one with poor judgment? Just because you are entirely lost to propriety doesn't mean that Bayard meant to follow in your footsteps. He knew what was owed to his name. It was that woman that he married. She was the one who caused the trouble.
No,
said Anne again. She took a step forward, her eyes fixed on Janie's mother's face.
Did she stab him, Aunt Alva? Was that what happened? She took a knife and stabbed Bay in the chest while you looked on and did nothing?
Mrs. Van Dyvel faltered in her erratic path. She looked over her shoulder again, furtive, waiting.
It all happened very quickly. Was there a struggle? Did Bay fight her? He was a tall man, Bay, and Annabelle was a little thing. It would have been a very unequal contest. But Bay would have been trying not to hurt her. That's a great disadvantage in a quarrel, isn't it, Aunt Alva?
Janie's mother breathed in through her nose.
I don't want to talk about it. No? Don't you want to put it all to rest? Let us know exactly what happened so we can sleep at night? Or is it because you're lying?
Anne stopped, her face distorted with grief and anger.
You know as well as I do that David Proyne was never Annabelle's lover. Don't be... Ridiculous?
Anne provided.
What's ridiculous is the idea that David Proyne wanted anything to do with Annabelle. I was the one who introduced Bay to David. Did you know that? David didn't give a fig for Annabelle, only for Bay. Do I need to make it plainer for you, Aunt Alva? Or did you know already?
Janie felt Burke's quick exhalation, saw the quick disgust on Giles Lacey's face.
I don't understand.
She said. Anne didn't waste breath in insults. She kept her eyes locked on Mrs. Van Dyvel's.
David wasn't Annabelle's lover. He was Bay's. Annabelle kept their secret for them.
There was a rumbling in Janie's ears. It took her a moment to realize that the sound wasn't coming from her head, but from the chimney. The smoke was thicker, bits of dust mixing with the coal.
Not anymore!
Her mother's voice rose over the din.
She was going to divorce him. I couldn't allow that. Do you know what people would have said if she'd gone through with it? Can you imagine the scandal?
Burke's hand closed hard around Janie's shoulder.
Better to have a dead son than a disgraced one?
You!
Janie's mother whirled to face Burke.
None of this goes into your disgraceful scandal sheet. It's pure rumor, malicious rumor. Anne doesn't know what she's talking about. If I see one word of it, I'll...
Kill him, provided Anne.
Black taffeta rustled as Janie's mother flung herself at Anne, grabbing her by the neck and shaking hard.
Shut your mouth!
Burke was fast, but Lacey was faster. It took both of them to pry Mrs. Van Dyvel off her niece's throat. They dragged her away from Anne, one holding each arm, as Mrs. Van Dyvel's voice rose against the howling of the wind.
It was her fault, all her fault. I never would have... It was an accident. She made me do it. It should have been her.
Anne breathed in with a terrible gasping sound, her hands at her throat. She stumbled backwards, catching herself against the side of a chair.
No. No, no.
It took Janie a moment to realize that the word was coming out of her own mouth, over and over. She pressed her hand against her lips as though that could make it stop.
How could you? Bay!
Don't you speak to me of my son!
Mrs. Van Dyvel yanked her arms away from her captors. Her entire body shaking with grief and rage. Her fingers clawed at her collar, sending jet beads scattering across the carpet.
Don't you think I see his face before me every moment of every day? My son! My son!
There was something terrifying about the scope of her mother's grief. Grief without consolation. Hecuba, rending her soot-stained clothes at the gates of Troy. David crying for Absalom.
You might, said Anne, her voice shaking, have thought of that before you stabbed him. I didn't. The knife. It was her fault. All her fault.
Behind her came an ominous rumbling, as though the masonry of the house itself were murmuring in agreement. Mrs. Van Dyvel raised her arms to the heavens.
I would kill her again if I could. I hope she's burning in all the fires of hell.
A fusillade of dust and ash exploded into the room. Someone shouted out. Janie blundered into a piece of furniture, blinded by the ash, her chest on fire. She couldn't hear. She couldn't see. She groped in the smoke, her eyes streaming. Something rumbled and screeched like demons run amok, breaking and shattering, shouting and clawing. There was a cry, and glass shattered, sending freezing air driving into the room. Janie wrapped her arms around her middle, staggering in the direction of cold. Cold meant outdoors, and outdoors meant away from the smoke and dust. Janie's cheeks stung, singed by flying ash. Through her stinging eyes, she could see Giles Lacey doubled over, coughing up smoke. Anne standing by the French door she'd broken open, cradling one arm, breathing deeply of the freezing air. Her mother sat on the floor, holding one hand to the gash on her forehead.
She's come from hell.
Janie's mother was staring at the blood on her fingers, her hair fallen from its pins, her black taffeta gray with ash.
She's come from hell to haunt me.
What in the devil?
Gasped Giles Lacey.
Not the devil, the chimney.
Sparks had lit on the furniture, chewing at the upholstery, the carpet, the drapes. Janie ran to go stamp one out, but Burke grabbed her by the arm.
We need to get everyone out. Now!
Anne yanked at the remains of the French door. Glass crunched beneath her heels.
This way,
she began, but shied back as a pile of masonry tumbled down outside the French doors in a rain of soot and mortar. Bricks fell to the pavement like hail. Burke swore beneath his breath.
Quick!
Reversing direction, he ran with Janie to the double doors to the passage, Anne on their heels, Giles Lacey half-pulling, half-carrying a stunned Mrs. Van Dyvel.
With this wind, it won't take long for the whole place to go up.
The air was relatively clear in the hall. Janie took a choking breath, staring at Burke with fear-filled eyes.
The children! They're in the nursery!
Where?
Burke didn't waste time with extraneous words.
On the third floor.
Two stories above the parlor, on the same flue. Janie didn't wait for Burke to say anything else. She lifted her skirts and took off running. Behind her, she could hear Burke's voice raised in command.
Lacey, come with me. Mrs. Newland, you get the servants out.
If Anne demurred or argued, Janie didn't hear it. She was already halfway up the stairs, trying to remember the plan of the house, wishing that she had paid more attention when Bay had offered to give her the tour. The nurseries faced east and south.
Is there anyone else in the house?
Burke caught up with her, taking the stairs two steps at a time.
The garrets!
The higher they went, the more strongly Janie smelled smoke. She had to struggle to form the words, although she wasn't sure if it was the smoke or the fear strangling her.
The kitchen maid? Mother's maid?
The grand stair only went to the second floor. For the third, one needed to take a smaller side stair. The handle was hot to her hand. Janie wrenched open the door and began coughing again as smoke billowed down. Burke pulled her back, slamming the door.
Is there another way?
The servant stairs,
said Lacey with the authority of the man who owned the original house.
If we go back through the west wing...
Janie shook her head.
Stair. Annabelle's room. She had a private stair put through to the night nursery.
Janie took a step back and nearly bumped into her mother, there behind her.
What are you...
Do you think I would leave Bay's son?
Her mother's hair was gray with ashes, her dress torn.
"Don't just stand there. Go."
"Annabelle's room is this way,"
Janey said, and didn't wait to see if her mother followed. Surely her mother wouldn't... No, she couldn't even think that. But she took comfort in Burke's presence beside her as they careened into Annabelle's rooms, nearly crying at the sound of a familiar voice crying,
"But I need Polly!"
Annabelle's suite was thick with smoke, but through it Janey could make out the children's nurse, bast in her arms, Viola fighting to try to get away from her grasp. Janey ran forward, but Burke was faster. He snatched Bass up and thrust him into Janie's arms just in time to catch the nurse before she toppled. There was a gash on the nurse's forehead and soot on her uniform.
"I need to get Polly!"
Janey snagged Viola by the back of her pinafore, hoisting her protesting into her arms.
"Hush, sweetling."
She locked her arms around Viola, hiding her tears in her hair.
"We'll get you a new duck, but now we need to go."
"Come on,"
said Lacey, and kicked the door open, only to shy back as with a roar and a crack a beam fell from the hall ceiling, knocking over the oil lamp that sat on a table outside Annabelle's room. A lake of fire spread around them.
"This way."
Janie's mother's voice was hoarse with smoke, but as autocratic as ever. It was impossible to imagine her as the clawing, shouting thing Janey had seen in the parlor. She gestured them through Annabelle's bedroom to her sitting room, where the window looked out over the breakfast room.
"There's a ledge."
Janey could have cried to see it. It was one of the many Gothic extravagances of the house, a stone roof over the triple windows of the breakfast room.
"Lacey,"
said Burke, kicking the door to the bedroom shut behind them. Even with the door closed, Janey could feel the heat of the spreading fire. Burke's face was streaked with soot and sweat.
"You go down and I'll hand the children down to you."
"Here." Lacey handed Bast to Janey's mother and lowered himself out the window onto the ledge, jumping from there onto the ground. The snow and the heat haze combined to form a sort of fog. Janey could see his face slipping in and out.
"All right,"
Burke said to Janey. And she nodded, even though she was anything but all right. Nodded because Viola was clinging to her neck, no longer crying for Polly, but silent with fear. To the nurse he said,
"You next. When I hand them down to you, take them to the old house. Do you understand?"
He dropped down to the ledge and held out his arms for Viola.
"Come on, Polly."
"Polly,"
said Viola, forgetting to be scared in her annoyance.
"Is the duck?"
"Right," said Burke. "Of course she is."
And he handed Viola down to Lacey, who staggered a bit, but set her down safely.
"Take the boy!"
It was her mother, voice tense with anxiety, thrusting Sebastian into Janie's arms.
"Sebastian," muttered Janey. "His name is Sebastian. Don't worry, Sebastian. It's all right. You're all right."
She could feel the heat through the back of her dress, making her skin crisp. The wind was arctic, the snow blew in her face, but her hair felt as though it was singeing on the back of her neck. Blinking her stinging eyes, she could see Anne, blessed Anne, swinging up one of the twins, urging everyone on. There were more shadowed forms in the snow. The Garretts, the kitchen maid, the nursery maid, others who Janey didn't remember and didn't recognize. But Anne had them all in hand, herding them relentlessly toward the shelter of the old house, as the storm winds raged around them, blowing snow and fire.
"Now you!"
shouted Burke, reaching up. They both shied back as something cracked and a stinging rain of diamonds cascaded past, rainbow-hued in the orange-red light of the fire. It was the windows, Janey realized, disbelieving. The windows in the nursery had burst, scattering glass everywhere. Fire roared out where the windows had once been. From far away, Janey could hear Lacey swearing. Then Burke's hand appeared out of the smoke, and she heard his voice, thick with fear, saying,
"Quickly!"
Janey swung her legs over the ledge and went, never minding the snow, never minding how she slipped and slid. All that mattered was getting away before something else crumbled. Burke's hand was warm and steady on hers, and then Giles Lacey had her around the waist, swinging her to the ground. and there was a part of Janie's mind that marveled that Giles Lacey, of all people, should be saving her life, before her feet and their impractical shoes sank calf-deep into the snow, and she nearly cried with relief. But for the fact that Burke was still on the ledge, his jacket